having done that, if everyone's okay, welcome everybody. We've got quite a busy session today, so we've done that bit. So we've got this session we're rerunning. We did it a couple of weeks ago, and to be fair, we were not as well prepared as I wanted to be for it, and things have changed this week. So because there's lots of new people coming in, the objective of this is to have a discussion, informed discussion. We've done a lot of reading and research, and as you know, we've been in the industry for many years. So we have some historical information to fall back on to help put things into perspective. It's not designed to provide you any kind of specific advice. It's meant to be wide ranging. We might take devil's advocate position. We might challenge each other. Hopefully we will do. The idea of it is to kind of stimulate and provoke discussion and thought, either in this forum or in your own forum. So it's also based on a snapshot in time. The law, as you know, as you've seen in the last few weeks, is evolving, as is the interpretation of the law and the guidance. So whatever we say in here may or may not be accurate in the future. We might change our opinions based on how things evolve. So I think that's important to say that, just so that you don't go off and start acting upon anything that's discussed about in this session. And so welcome everybody. Welcome Ollie. Welcome Dave Holmes when he gets here. Hopefully Dave, when you get here, then you know, put your hand up and dive in. So what we're going to talk about today are a lot of new changes that have come through in the last couple of weeks. So new standard contractual clauses, which we might refer to as SCCs. We'll unpack those shortly and go through what they are. Also, by the way, we made the unprecedented step of having a PowerPoint presentation to help us structure through, because there's an awful lot of content to get through. So again, this will be available at the end of the session. We're going to talk through two sets of recommendations the European Data Protection Board have issued in the last couple of weeks. We're going to talk about, I know that Dave was challenging me last night as I was wandering around Lidl, about data transiting countries. You know, if it goes through a country, is that classified as a transfer? And there's some conflicting advice about this. So that'd be a really interesting discussion. He then rang me up a bit later on in the evening when I was tucking into a glass of wine to challenge me on whether the Convention 108 Plus helps UK adequacy. We're going to try and talk a bit about industry opinion. There's an awful lot of blogs out there, some really good and some, you know, not so good, and also some ICO advice. So, Ollie, we're going to chat through this. Have you been digging into it? Oh, I thought what we'd do, Kathy, as a Christmas gift to all our staff is to have cartoons made up of ourselves. I thought that was very much like Ollie, this one here.
Oh, right.
And this is probably you over here. And this is Dilik over here, isn't it?
I don't ask which is me then.
So maybe we'll commission someone to do something like onto us.
Who's the like one?
David. It's too much hair for David Holmes. I don't know. Right, Ollie, are you there?
I am indeed. I'm just keeping quiet because I don't want to invoke David's wrath when he eventually gets on.
So we're going to have a chat through this, Rob. But first of all, I mean, I think it's useful just to quickly touch on, it's been a fast-moving month, hasn't it, this? You know, I've got the road run here. This is a, you've got to really be on your toes, don't you, to keep track of all this stuff. We've got the Ticketmaster fine, only 1.25 million. But that was quite instructive, wasn't it, when you read through that, and there was a lot of information in there about PCI DSS and failure to protect cardholder data. So that was interesting. And then there was the Experian enforcement notice. I had a quick check yesterday. There's 82 decision notices relating to fear information and environmental information regulations. One, it was interesting because some guy was trying to argue with DVLC that number plates weren't personal data, and therefore, you know, they should be disclosable because according to DVLC, they belong to the Secretary of State and used to identify vehicles, not people. Anyway, that was quite an interesting decision notice to read. I don't know if you read the report on political parties, and very interesting, actually, Kathy sent this to you, a report on subject access requests in the education sector. I don't know if you saw those.
When did you send that to me?
No, I haven't yet. I'm going to. Okay. But I mean, in a nutshell, you know, there's one page of positives and about 25 pages of negatives. Typical stuff, you know, not being prepared for requests like policy procedures, you know, guidance to data subjects, no training, inability to recognise a request, managing requests, you know, weak processes, finding data, you know, criticism of retention of emails, no structure to QA-ing the work of the reviewers, no kind of policy around exemptions, poor cover letters on the response, continual improvement process not there. So that's really useful to read because, you know, we can take from this where the ICO expects us all to be in respect to SAR. So that was quite fun. And then, of course, the reissue of Article 46, which is probably what we're focused on today, standard contractual clauses, they relate to international transfers. And also the issue of Article 28, standard contractual clause, which is quite interesting because these are process agreements. So do you have a chance to look at those, Ollie?
I've been digging primarily into the Article 46 ones, just in the interest of the sort of continuation with international transfers, Brexit, all following on, obviously, from Privacy Shield a few months ago. So sticking in that vein primarily from my point of view.
I think what we'll probably do is we'll change our guidance and our information governance framework, assuming that the European Commission's new Article 28 standard contractual clauses are any good, and we'll decommission the ones we currently recommend, the Danish one, the Crown Commercial Services, and the DLA Pipe one. Dave Hendry threw me a curveball. He said, oh, the ICO's resigned the other day. And it took me a while to get to the bottom of it, but it's a five-year term, isn't it? So she actually finishes in July. And will be replaced by. So I can't believe she's been in place for 5 years. Can you?
Yeah. Well, I've only been in this job for two, so.
Right. No, and then another interesting one, Manchester United. I read the other day there was a foiled cyber attack, but as it would appear today in the Mail, it's actually a successful cyber attack, and they're apparently currently being held to ransom. So that was interesting because we did a bit of work with the football clubs this week. And, you know, if you had your systems knocked out on a match day, you'd potentially end up with upwards of, you know, 40,000 people on the pavement trying to get in. But you don't currently because of the COVID restrictions. But in the future, you know, it's a public order issue. So it's really important to get, you know, to get these things nailed down. Anything you noticed in the news, Ollie? I know I've been rabbited on a bit, so I shall shut up for a minute.
No, nothing outside of what you've just mentioned. To me, the essence of it really has been the standard contractual clause. I say that's what I've been looking into primarily.
Yeah, okay. So you're doing this. I get that on your day off.
Yeah.
So into the meat of the session then, international data transfers. So quite a few people have asked us to kind of delve into this. It is very fast moving. And we're going to primarily focus on three items of documentation recently issued by the European Data Protection Board. It does kind of beg the question, well, who will the European Data Protection Board be come January? But, you know, I think we should be picking up on that as well. You know, do we have to pay any attention to them after January? You know, that's an interesting point. So we're going to cover off these because these are really interesting and important. And actually, you know, there's an awful lot of work that's going to have to go into any international transfers going forward now. The first one to talk through is this. We're going to step through a flow chart I've put together, Ollie, just to try and structure the discussion. But I don't know if you read these then, the recommendations O2. These to me are the start of it rather than the O2 recommendations, the European Essential Guarantees for Surveillance Measures. Did you have a chance to look at them?
I've had a glance through them, but I think it'd be probably quite helpful for us if you give us a quick run through, if that's all right.
Yeah, sure. Well, we'll cover off. But basically, this says that if you're trying to determine the law and practice measures of a third country where you want to transfer data to, you need to look at four particular things that should be guaranteed. Yeah, one is they should have a clearly defined set of rules by which government might engage to review personal data. So that's the first thing. We'll go into it in a bit more detail in a minute. But those interventions by the government in terms of hoovering up personal data to look at have to be based on the notions of proportionality and necessity, so national security, you know, rather than it being indiscriminate. So that's the second guarantee that should be there. The third guarantee is that there has to be, or should be, if it has to be, an independent oversight mechanism. Now, this is going to be interesting. We'll talk about this in a bit. You know, what is independent? So this is an independent oversight mechanism. The UK is credited, actually, for having the ICO, who is clearly having a pop at government departments every now and again. So that's, you know, what we would call an independent oversight. Maybe the courts might be independent, but in America, I think it's the Department of Justice that oversees a lot of this stuff, and Department of Foreign Affairs, or whatever it's called, and that might not be independent. And then the fourth essential guarantee is there have to be effective remedies in the country. So that this really, again, this will make more sense in a minute, but these are the four guarantees that would sort of guarantee that the surveillance measures in a particular country are equivalent to or allowing an equivalent data subject rights effectively for data subjects. So that's what that document does.
Yeah, I mean, to my mind, it is essentially setting out what were inherently the flaws in Privacy Shield. The fact that you didn't have remedies for data subjects or an independent mechanism for that oversight. You didn't have the effective remedies. It wasn't necessarily always proportionate. And there was, and I think we're going to get onto it later, issues around FISA and the applicability of it. So to my mind, it really reflects that. I don't know, that was my initial gut feeling on it anyway.
Yeah, I did a bit of historic reading today, looking back over some of the European, the Working Party 29 work back in 1998. And actually, these issues were still being discussed back then, you know, as the directive came into effect, the supervisory authorities were discussing these issues have now come to a head and we've had to deal with them. But it's not a new issue. This has been kicking about for a long time. So that's that one. But hopefully will make sense in a minute. If it doesn't, then people need to tell us to go into a bit more detail and make it make sense. But this second document, again, this is quite a meaty one, isn't it? And this is really where we get into the detail, really, which I think this should be recommendation two and the other one should be recommendation one. But anyway, it isn't. So this sets out six steps that one must take if one wants to transfer personal data to a third country. OK, so I think we've talked about these last time, haven't we? So you've got to know your transfers. You've got to verify which Chapter 5 transfer mechanism you want to use, Chapter 5 being within the GDPR. You've got to assess the third country's law or practices, which is why I think, that's where this links together. So how do you do that? Well, you look at these European essential guarantees for surveillance and you ask all the relevant questions in there. Are there those four guarantees? Is there evidence of those four guarantees being in place? Then you decide, if you can proceed, and we'll look at a flow chart in a minute, we'll step through it. Then you adopt, identify and adopt your mechanisms, let's say standard contractual clauses, and then you're into this recommendation 01, which is what are the supplementary measures. We're going to unpack those in a minute. Fifth step is you might need some kind of formal procedural step. So if you're working on binding corporate rules, for instance, you'd have to go and get those approved by the supervisory authority. So that's a procedural step you might have to take. And then the sixth step in this recommendation 01 is keep things under review because it's likely to change. Is that pretty much your take on it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really good step in the right direction, these recommendations, because I think it sets it out really quite clearly. I think we'll probably get onto it shortly, but even providing the examples under its annexes for the types of additional measures you should be looking into, I think it definitely brings some much needed clarity to the area.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll put this together to try and kind of step through and tease out the various points. So this is the flow of these six steps. There's only five blobs because the sixth step is a review, but to kind of know your transfer. So, we should be okay with that, shouldn't we? Because we should have these all documented. The question is where and to what depth. What's your experience, Ollie, working with some of our clients on, the extent to which they've got all these processor agreements, sharing agreements, transfers documented?
Yeah, generally, it's not a colossal issue when it's a direct relationship with a third party that's outside or that's in a third country, rather, because often there's a good awareness of that and it's a documented risk. So let's say some of our clients who might use MailChimp or SurveyMonkey or those are the two most prevalent ones, but any of the other suppliers who are directly in America a lot of the time, there's generally a good awareness of that. I think where it falls down a lot of the time is perhaps when it's a sub-processor for one of their suppliers that's in a third country, and then all of a sudden there's a little bit more confusion. They're not necessarily always aware that this is the case. I think we'll probably get onto it later. I saw in your notes, but the concept of data that's in transit, I think that's where the lines really start to blur. Actually, speaking of which, Becky asks us a question on the chat, and she asks, what actually denotes transferring data outside of the UK? Our storage of data on servers in the EU, such as via a Microsoft solution, for example. So whether essentially storing data on servers in a third country constitutes a transfer out of the UK.
Yeah, I mean, definitely it does. Yeah, it's one of the 100%. Examples used in this recommendation, though, too, isn't it? You know, in fact, we can go into that in detail because there's actually a good use case spelt out in the recommendations. I put this up on the screen because this is a list of sub-processes which we get periodically from Salesforce. So you're quite right, Ollie, in my view. You know, you might know that Salesforce is a processor, but you might not know who else is processing the personal data. So there's quite a long load of gobbledygook here. But when you get down to it, it's kind of like, well, these are where we, Salesforce, are storing the information that you store in our system. Now, we use Salesforce. We're on this British data center, and currently our backup is in Germany. So you know, when we log on, we get a URL that tells where it is. But we've got lots of plugins. So we use Conga Composer to render PDFs, and we use DocuSign. Well, you know, they're not on this list because they're not classified as sub-processes of Salesforce. We've selected and elected to plug them in and to use them. So you can see here, you know, where the extent of all the transfers, and what they're saying here is that you know, there's no guarantee that your data stays in one place. It could end up in Italy or India or the Philippines or the United States. It's a big job, isn't it, if you want to use a system like this?
I think you're absolutely spot on. I don't know if she's on currently, but our colleague Dilek, one of her main questions when she's undertaking DPIAs and we're talking about data centers is where the failover center is.
Yeah.
Because that's something that you should really consider. But a lot of the time, it's something that isn't considered. And all of a sudden, you know, you might have thought that you were using a UK-based supplier, but it turns out your data's in a third country, or there's a very strong chance that it might be transferred there. Yeah. So, no, it's definitely quite complicated.
I read a really interesting article this morning, or yesterday, can't remember which now, by David Smith, you know, the former deputy ICO?
Yes.
And he was painting scenarios about the transfers of data, and he said, you might transfer data to somebody, you can actually justify these supplementary measures with, but then the whole thing might change, you know, and then you might find that there's something that changes, and all of a sudden they fall outside of the scope of those supplementary measures. So it is it's going to be a moving feast, isn't it?
If I can jump in there, Phil, because
David.
You were certainly covering a lot of really relevant stuff, and I didn't want to jump in too soon.
I wanted you to jump in, mate.
I didn't want to jump in just to break the flow, because both you and Ollie were... but both you and Ollie were really highlighting some really, really key points, and I sometimes wonder, just listening to it back, especially around the due diligence when we're looking at, do we know who our processors are and do we know who they're processing, is whether the sub-processes in that sense, is to whether some of the processes that we may work with, especially with some of the clients that we have within the housing sector, when you go through that due diligence process and you're looking at the responses, just whether there's a greater need for organisations to be aware of what actually is processing, what are transfers. Because you see, or I've certainly seen on some of the due diligence forms that have come back, an organisation saying, no, we don't do any subcontracting, but we've got a cloud provider.
Yeah,
for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Classic.
That's kind of understanding and training issue, isn't it? That's something that, you know, everyone should be aware of what is processing these days, I think. Maybe I'm rose-tinted glasses again.
No, for sure. But it's like I say, it's when you're going through this kind of process of, well, do we know where our data is? You're getting into a point trying to assist the process, especially smaller scale processes. I wouldn't necessarily accept the same kind of response back from Microsoft or one of the large housing management systems to kind of give you that response, because that would certainly raise alarms, because you'd think that they've got the resources to know and understand that. But when you're using smaller processes that might have less knowledge, you sometimes find you're having to kind of take them through the process with you. In identifying, well, if you've got a cloud provider, do you know where the cloud is? And well, no, it's just this cloud provider that we use for security purposes. And then you're having to educate them about, well, that is a form of processing and you need to go through this form of identifying who you're working with and what they're doing with the information and where that's going. And a lot of people then just start, in essence, although it's a lot of it's done through telephone calls, you can just imagine a rabbit in the headlights of a car when you start talking to some of the small processors around it.
I know. Well, see, we never really used to bother that much about it, did we? I mean, in my experience, and, you know, in the past, it was, you know, oh, it's Privacy Shield, tick, move on. Or, you know, we're using SEC, tick, move on. But, you know, the ball game's changed, hasn't it, now?
Yeah, quite a lot of questions coming in, Guy. I don't know whether you want me to interrupt and ask them now.
You can do. I can't see the chat, but yeah, by all means do, yeah.
Okay, so we've got one from Rebecca Marr. We and other orgs have heard from can't get Microsoft to move our storage to the UK from the EU until July 2022. What steps should we be taking now?
Well, we're going to come on to that, to be honest. Okay. So if we don't answer your question, Rebecca, come back and say that's all well and good. But you haven't answered my question yet, but I think we will cover that off.
Yeah, okay. And then we've got a question from Maria Cooper. If your data is based on a UK server but may be accessed by someone in a third country, this would also constitute a transfer?
Yeah, that will, and we'll cover off that as well. So, you know, the fantastic questions, and hopefully we'll, you know, it's all in this guidance note. All those scenarios are in these guidance notes we're going to talk through.
Okay. And then final one, are SCC sufficient for us? Software, please. A lot of our schools use Class.
We'll come on to this as well. We'll come on to this. Let me up the pace a bit. We'll try and have a chat through this lot, and then we'll come back to those questions and more. Yeah, if that's okay.
Perfect.
Right. Okay. So we've got to know where our data is. Next step is I get my mouse on the right screen. That's always a good plan. Is we got to know verify your transfer mechanism. So, you know, we know where a transfer is. It's going to EEA or somewhere with adequacy like Japan. Therefore, green light to go, off we go. If it's no, then we've got to look for something like standard contractual clauses or binding corporate rules. Interesting. When I was talking to football clubs the other day, they were talking about using Article 49 derogations. I said, you can't use those. So far too narrowly construed. Anyway, that's a different story, isn't it? Any comment on this, Dave? So, I mean, my view is you look at your adequacy, you find that, you know, you're going to a third country without adequacy, not in the EEA, like America or like Australia or like India. So then you're back into this kind of third step of, okay, fine, we've got to now assess the law and the practice of those territories. Any comments on this? I think we need to get on, don't we, so we can get into these specific questions people have asked.
I think we do need to go on. I think it's quite valid, though, is trying to work out, well, what's the mechanism at the moment and what do we need? What mechanism do we need? So that kind of brings up whether a BTR's standard contractual clauses or whether the EU's approved a country as being adequate, which I'm guessing we'll also cover potentially at some point Brexit. But let's park that one and let's continue through.
Yeah, and of course, there's also for public authority people, there's a public authorities kind of not standard contractual clause, not binding corporate rules, but the public authority arrangement. There's those as well, which are valid. They're all listed in Article 46, aren't they, the GDPR, these arrangements. So you're into the third step now, which is assessing the law and the practice of the country that you want to transfer the data to. Now, I know you've done a lot of work, Dave, looking at FISA, the American Foreign, whatever it's called.
Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
That's one, yeah. And I've got some information about that. So let's say that you do these four steps you talked about earlier, you know, looking at those four specific aspects of the territory. You know, is the clear defined rules, are they proportionate and based on necessity, et cetera, et cetera. So if you come back with, we can't satisfy these EEGs, then really we can't transfer the data. Your recourse might then be to lobby the ICO, talk to the ICO about it. But if you can satisfy the EEGs, then you're into the next step of the equation. But just on FISA, and what was interesting to me, Dave, is that it looks like it's up to us to go through this evaluation. Is that your reading as well of these advice notes? I mean, it's quite clear. It says you have to do this and you have to do that, doesn't it? It doesn't say the supervisory authority or the court. It says you have to do it.
No, as a controller, it'll be you having to do it and to go through it. What kind of really stuck out for me was for FISA, though, was in particular the extraterritorial reach that it has. It's certainly doesn't appear to be a law that is restrained just to America only.
It's quite the opposite. In fact, US citizens cannot be investigated using Pfizer, can they? It's only overseas citizens.
For sure, for sure. Pfizer is for non-US citizens. But like I say, it's not just touting non-US citizens and information in the US. So if you've got a US parent company with an EU subsidy, then potentially they're still caught by Pfizer. And that's kind of the extraterritorial reach that it's got. And in particular, the belief is that it has got this extraterritorial reach because there was problems with US law previously and the Distorted Communications Act that wasn't considered as extraterritorial by the US courts. So then the US government then brought out the Cloud Act in order to rectify that and now all that kind of implications behind it.
It seems to me that it definitely has extraterritorial reach, and really the proof of the pudding's in whether it works or not, and it looks like it works. You know, you read in the press about the US government, you know, demanding data from Apple and having it unencrypted, don't you, and other places. But this was an interesting slide, because if we're going to go through these four steps to establish, you know, is this country we want to transfer data to America, does it pass the EEG's test? You know, I would say, well, I've read through the Pfizer 702, and actually I think it is quite well defined. It does define what they want to use it for, and I think there's probably, in my opinion, proportionality there. Now, you might come to a different conclusion, but where does that leave us? Yeah, where does that leave us as privacy practitioners? You know, we're not going to all apply the same level of judgment. Are we in these things?
No, likewise, and I'm sure within the guidance it says we've got the opinion's got to be an objective opinion, not a subjective opinion as well. So it's demonstrating that, isn't it, in order to address the accountability principle, why you feel it is proportional if you're saying it is, and the use of and certainly not arguing it isn't. It has to be a case by case basis. You couldn't take a kind of a blanket approach to it either, but you're going to have to demonstrate that in an objective way.
Yeah, and then, you know, the independence of oversight. So, I would say, well, I'm not sure whether the Department of Justice overviewing this request process and approving requests for information is independent enough. So I'd put a question mark in there. But you might say, actually, I think that's fine. Or they might say, no, that's definitely not fine. But the bit that America seems to fail on is these effective remedies, doesn't it?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, who would you go to in that scenario? I think the effective remedies part ties in quite closely to the independent oversight aspect, because fundamentally, who do you go to if you have a qualm with this? There's no ombudsman. And as you said, I don't think the Department of Justice would be sufficiently independent enough for you to have an effective remedy.
Yeah. So moving on through this process, we're then into this toolkit, this supplementary measures recommendation 02, and these are really interesting. Remember, we talked about them the other week, and we had Jason. He was talking about warrant controls. He'd actually read it all, and I'd only read the first few pages of it. I've now read it all, and I've understood it. The supplementary measures are split into three types, which, again, we talked about this last time. You know, we've now got not only technical and organisational measures, we've also got contractual measures being something that's in there. And the guidance gives us seven specific use cases of technical measures. It talks about encryption of data and pseudonymisation. Have you read this far in it, Dave?
I've read it through briefly, because there was a query that came in from a client yesterday in relation to
you've gone.
Transport layers. Hello?
Yeah, he's here back. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I was looking. Well, not yesterday, sorry. The query came in from a client yesterday, so I was just having a quick review back, because they raised the question of whether it's a transfer or just a transit of information. So they were transiting information for through email via the US. So it would have gone from the UK to the UK, but it's bounced to the US. And would that be a transfer or a transit? So then I was looking into transport layer security, which captures possibly transiting data.
Yeah. Well, the guidance gives us five technical measures that it says would be effective and two that wouldn't. Data in the clear was interesting. I had to figure out what data in the clear. It basically means clear text data. So transferring clear text data, they're saying you cannot possibly provide kind of enough safeguarding around that. So, you know, that transmitting data overseas into a third country that's plain text data isn't acceptable. And then they've got some kind of use cases around, you know, somebody else using data for their own purposes. And then they say, well, if that's the case, that's also not acceptable. But the things to say, you know, you could potentially work are transmitting data to a third country that's encrypted. And then, as you say, using transport layer security that's strong and potentially, you know, only sending pseudonymized or compartmentalized data. So we have to think, I think, long and hard about, you know, how we are moving data and how it's protected from where we are in the UK to that third country in order to, you know, to be able to demonstrate that we've got these supplementary measures in place. And they're not that simple because, you know, for instance, somebody on this encryption, they've said, well, if you've got these six things in place, then that's probably okay. And on the pseudonymization, if you've got these four things in place, that's probably okay. But what it does provide us with is kind of quite a lot of guidance, you know, a checklist of things that we could do, and we'll try and bring that to life in a minute. The org measures, things like policies, accountability and transparency, you know, data minimization measures, you know, sticking to recognised standards, and some other bits and pieces. And the contractual measures, you know, things like, you know, additional rights of audit over a processor, or, you know, enforcing them to use particular technologies by law, but by contract. But what the guidance says is that organizational measures and contractual measures alone will not suffice. You have to have technical measures as well. Did you pick up the same points, Dave, Ollie?
I did, because I think contractually it only binds the importer. It doesn't necessarily, due to the way contracts work, would bind public authorities within the country that it was destined to. So therefore contractual measures can work, but it doesn't mean that you, it certainly means that you need to consider a greater range of technical measures that sit behind that. That's certainly going to put a great deal of more onus on undertake a greater level of due diligence relating around the types of security needed and whether the types of security are going to be appropriate for what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah. There's also, of course, not every country in the world allows encryption. So the obvious one is China, but I was surprised that Australia has banned encryption. I didn't know that. And then I found quite an interesting map of, you know, which countries have got what controls and, you know, open to encryption and not open to encryption. So there's quite a lot of information out there about this type of stuff. But you might want to enforce encryption and find that actually it's prohibited in the country you're wanting to transfer data to. That'd be a problem, wouldn't it?
I think it'll be a big problem for a lot of people. I think. But my starting point is it's all a bit of a complete mess. But when you start focusing on the security side of things and local laws and cans and can'ts and that kind of thing, it's going to take a lot more work to appoint a supplier.
Yeah. I mean, this is the interesting sort of slide here. So obligations to provide assist authorities, you know, the UK, France, Holland, Belgium, all clearly, you know, with rules like our Snoopers Charter, you know, no different from the United States of America. Yeah, you know, we're calling it a problem. And also, you know, obligation on individuals to assist the authorities.
Because the other thing as well, isn't it? Because you've got the UK and the US as part of the Five Eyes thing, which then drags in Australia, but Australia isn't deemed adequate under the EU rules anyway.
No, I know. What were you talking about, the 108 plus convention last night? Is it opportune time to? Oh, that's about Brexit, isn't it, really, and adequacy?
It's more to do with Brexit and adequacy and transfer mechanisms, because the US aren't a signatory to the international treaty. Or the international law in that sense. So it wouldn't cover anything going to the US.
Yeah, okay. So this is the Warrant Canary thing, isn't it? So Warrant Canary is basically a flag, again, whether it actually works in practice remains to be seen, but a flag that if it's there means that there's been no request for information. If it's gone, then there's been a request for information with the government. And companies like Slack published this in their transparency report. I have to say, this is the latest one, and it's nearly a year out of date. But, you know, they're meant to be publishing how many search warrants and court orders they've had for disclosure of personal data, foreign entities.
It's quite interesting that they've had subpoenas and 30 civil subpoenas, so that's from a layman's term that they've said they're not doing it unless you drag me to court, quite frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's interesting. I think it's been very transparent. I am rather cynical about them, but I think it's been rather transparent because it's you certainly wouldn't want to disclose information if it would give the game away on something in the very same way that the GDPR exemption, for example, you wouldn't disclose something if it was going to jeopardise an official investigation. So there is a little bit of me that's got a little bit of a cynic. It's kind of
well, absolutely, because one of these contractual safeguards for such measures is basically subjects. Oh, by the way, we've had a request for information from the police about you. Well, that ain't going to work, is it?
I think it looks good in paper. I think in practice, it's there to try to appease people. I don't think it's actually there in practice will actually work that way. Can you imagine anything that may jeopardise an investigation by MI5, MI6, or even the police, where they might just be trying to access something? Do you think they're going to give the game away by letting you know the police have requested it? I don't think so.
Absolutely not. No, it's probably laws to stop you doing that, as there is in the Data Protection Act. You know, you don't have to disclose that information. If it's exempt from disclosure, would you? Article 14 exemptions. I thought this, again, hopefully this will start to put things in place, but I was looking at a thing called Cognito Forms yesterday for a client. I was just doing some support desk work, and they use Cognito Forms to collect information from the tenants. It's a housing association, and I looked at Cognito Forms, and they're based in America, and they say on their terms of business that all the services are in America, and they have this declaration that they use Privacy Shield, which is of course null and void, but they also had standard contractual clauses and interestingly an incomplete processor agreement. So we want to go back and say you need to add these additional clauses into your processor agreement. But what we would need if we wanted to use Cognito Forms, in my view, again, chuck bricks at this by all means, is we need Article 28 standard contractual clauses because they're a processor. And we would need Article 46 standard contractual clauses for the international transfer element. And we'd need to have documentary evidence that we'd considered EEG supplementary measures, the essential guarantees, yeah? So, for instance, we could say, well, we're going to pseudonymize data. We're only going to store data in Cognito Forms that's been pseudonymized. We'll use some kind of tenant ID, for instance, as a way of referring to people. So, you know, to the US authorities, they don't know which tenant ID is which person, but we do when we get the reports back in again, for instance. We'll also encrypt data, or Cognito Forms might say, well, don't worry, because we will ensure that data is encrypted with, you know, strong key control. That means that only the data exporter has the cryptographic key to decrypt the data. So that would again be another suitable measure according to these recommendations. And to your point, Dave, you know, strong transport layer security, so that, you know, it's very, very strong encryption of the transportation of the data, therefore, you know, not possible to intercept and decrypt it. So you might say, well, we'll put those three technical measures in place in collaboration with Cognito Forms, and additional contractual measures like a contractual obligation to use all of the above. They call it no back doors, which is an interesting turn of phrase in these recommendations. So, you know, effectively, Cognito Forms declaring in the contract, warranting that they have no backdoors to their databases, which are permissible to be used by the authorities. You might also enforce strong audit provisions to check they're complying with their contractual obligations. You might have stronger transparency obligations, like a warrant canary, or this, what I've called whistleblowing, which is basically telling the data subject, by the way, we've had a request for information about you. And then you might insist that Cognito Forms have strong internal policies and procedures, government requests, find, you know, when they're going to respond, how they're going to respond, people are trained in the above, they've got good record keeping, and a commitment to keep things under review continually. Now, with all those things in place, it seems to me that a transfer could go ahead to Cognito Forms in the US. Is that your take on the situation?
For sure, because the under the Schrems decision, they didn't actually, the court didn't actually say standard contractual clauses were invalid. It's just the primacy of US laws and the ability to obtain data for surveillance purposes, or through FISA for accessing data in that sense. So therefore, if you take additional steps to enforce the measures under the standard contractual clauses, and they are changing, I don't know if you've mentioned that, we'll get onto that, but they are changing, so there will be a review of standard contractual clauses required by people relying on them. But as long as you support standard contractual clauses with appropriate technical measures, like you've indicated here with encryption or pseudonymization, then absolutely, there's no reason why it couldn't operate under the measures that you've indicated, because there's, like I said, the measures themselves weren't invalidated. The only thing that was invalidated was Privacy Shield.
Yeah. So I think we should get onto these questions now that are coming on. I just wanted to, before we do that, just want to go through this. So on the left here, we've got the ICO's current guidance gone to a website, although I have to say I found the ICO's guidance incredibly difficult to navigate these days. But they said here, transfer does not mean the same as transit. If personal data is just electronically routed through a non-EEA country, but the transfer is actually from one EEA country to another EEA country, then it's not a restricted transfer, obviously restricted transfer being one way you need one of these mechanisms in place for. That's what the ICO says on their website at the moment. However, in the recommendation of the European Data Protection Board, they do say that transferring data, routing data through a third country, is something that has to have is a restricted transfer. And they say, well, with all these 10 or 11 things in place, then transport encryption, etc., it's an effective supplementary measure. So I'm finding lots of conflicting information here in the guidance, and the ICO is our regulator. Once we've finally got out of the transitional period, then we'll be on our own, won't we? So who is the Data Protection Board anyway, and what is their advice in terms of its relevance after January? But there's a lot of conflicting advice out there, I found.
For sure, and these were the very two documents that I was looking at from a client yesterday, with the example that I set regarding an email, basically, in essence, going from the UK to the UK, but just via America, in that sense. And the question was, well, was it a transfer or was it a transit? And partly my response, in addition to looking at these, was, well, do you know, can they determine the difference between a transfer and a transit? So, for example, it wouldn't be a transit, arguably, if it went to America and stopped and then got forwarded on from a different process or through a different means. If it was kind of just a continuous kind of in and out, but it didn't stop anywhere. So it's that kind of, well, what actually happens? Can you determine what happens along the path? And does anything stop it from being a transit? If it's a pure transit, like the example gives, then you could say, well, it just kind of flows through their systems and doesn't stop, doesn't get copied, doesn't get kind of saved anyway. It's not accessible anyway. It just literally flies through and then hits the other part of the UK, in my client's example. Then you could say it was a straight transfer.
How do you know? And how do you know that, today, it goes down one route, and tomorrow, there's a problem, something's down for maintenance, and it goes a different route? It's impossible to keep on top of it, I think.
And I think that's possibly where the European sides come from, with the right hand side of what you're looking at with the encrypted bit, is, well, if you're going to send it and it's going to be a transit, then you're going to have to make sure it's secure, because of the very issues that you've raised with where, how do you actually know what happens to it? Do you know where it goes? What happens if something goes down? Where does it stop? Where does it start again? So therefore, even if it's a transit, you're still going to have to make sure that there's robust security in place, because otherwise, either from passive or active attempts to access that information, you're going to have to protect against it. You can't just go, well, it passes through, don't worry. There's still an obligation to make sure that's an appropriate, or at least an equivalent level of security behind it that you'd expect as if it was in the GDPR and in the EU.
Yeah. Let's have a look at these questions then. I mean, the we'll just kind of start at the top of things and work through. So Rebecca's saying Microsoft are going to move their storage to the UK in July 2020. What do we do in the meantime? Well, what's your thoughts on that, Dave? I mean, the ICO said, the UK government said, currently they recognise the EU as being adequate, don't they? So we're going to end up with the UK GDPR and the Data Protection Act. We'll have Chapter 5 in our UK GDPR, but what we're saying is that transfers to the EEA are permissible, aren't we?
Yeah, the UK is certainly saying going to the EU are fine. It's just coming back from the EU, but coming back from the EU to ourselves may work under standard contractual clause. It just depends whether you've gone through all the measures and they decided that actually the UK snoopers charter, if you want to call it that, may infringe that. So the very same conversations that we've been having about data going to the US could well be implications of data coming back to the UK from the EU.
Wouldn't that be Microsoft making that assessment, saying, you know, thanks for putting your data in our system, we can't let you have it because we don't think the Snoopers Charter is fair play. Is that how it works?
It'd be very difficult, isn't it? Because you think just how embedded Microsoft is across many organisations. You couldn't just switch Microsoft off overnight in that sense. And if Microsoft says, look, physically we can't storage to the UK until July 2022 at the earliest, then where are you left? You know what I mean? You're in kind of between a rock and a hard place with that.
You're okay in terms of exporting the data to Microsoft. It's Microsoft that European law, in wherever they are, before they can transfer it or allow you to transfer it back. So I guess Microsoft, you know, and all the others from a commercial standpoint will have to do something. But they'll be going through this process, I would have thought. They'll be saying, you know, we've got to put in place these EEGs. We'll assess the UK. Actually, we think the UK is okay. We've got to put in place supplementary measures. Right, okay, but we'll beef up our encryption. I mean, I would have thought that they would be going through this process right now. And they might not get it all in place before January. But, you know, they're not going to be wanting to just sit still and lose business or face fines in Europe, are they?
No, for sure. Like I said previously, it's all a bit of a mess, quite frankly. It's probably the easiest way to sum it all up. Yeah. Hopefully it's a moot point that we could spend a long time talking about. I'd like to think that that some kind of agreement is in place to facilitate things before January, just to ease stuff. And to facilitate stuff, because I think there was something like...
So you say agreement, do you mean between Microsoft and each of their customers?
No, sorry, I meant an adequacy agreement between the EU and the UK.
Oh, right, okay.
So it's a slightly different kind of a spin on things.
Okay, and if there isn't?
If there isn't, I come back to my first point, it's a complete mess.
Well, if there isn't, I would have thought Microsoft will kind of put in place new standard terms and conditions with their customers, having assessed the UK's legal law and practice regime and reviewed the technical measures that they've got in place to manage access to the data. And I would have thought that situation will actually not be a major problem.
No, for sure. And what I've been advising clients around that when they've been asking them, asking questions about what should we be doing with our software providers? What can we do to prepare for Brexit and the impending crisis that we're potentially facing? And I said, you've got to ask them what they're doing. So if you're using Microsoft, then or you've got a representative with Microsoft or any of the other providers, ask them. Ask them, what are you going to do about information coming back to the EU? Back to the UK if you're EU-based. What measures are you going to address? How are you going to put things in a way that could still facilitate that?
Yeah. Now, Maria is asking if database on the UK server accessed by someone in a third country constitutes a transfer. It certainly constitutes processing, doesn't it?
Yeah, I've long argued that access of data in a third country constitutes processing, even if the data doesn't actually move outside of the UK infrastructure. It's just being viewed or accessed in a third country. And I've often taken the stance, and feel free to disagree, but that would constitute an international transfer in theory. Yeah.
To back up what you said there, Ollie, as well, the European Data Protection Board frequently asked questions actually states that remote access from a third country outside of the EU is considered to be a transfer.
Yeah.
Excellent vindication.
Now, this question about Class Dojo, again, that's interesting. So it's not the standard contractual clauses is the issue, is it? It's the fact you have to now go through this process we've shown on the screen here of assessing the law and the practice in the USA where the data is going to get transferred to, and put in place these supplementary measures. So Class Dojo really need to wake up and get their house in order, I would have said. What's your thoughts, Dave, Ollie?
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I'd personally be concerned if a supplier who is aware of these obligations or should be aware of these obligations is dragging their feet. To me, that would be a bit of a red flag, really. And I think you get to a point where maybe you start to suggest that you'll start looking elsewhere if they continue to drag their heels. But I don't know if that's, you know, just not feasible in practice from a commercial standpoint.
I would have backed up as well what you said there, Ollie and Phil, because standard contractual clause wouldn't be sufficient for America because of the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. having access to cloud and cloud-based operators are caught by Pfizer. So I said, just on their own without additional measures, it wouldn't be enough.
Yeah, what's going to happen is that, you know, these bigger organisations, these global players, will kind of do the legwork for us. One of your questions last night, Dave, on the phone was, you know, how are you meant to get around all these different countries and assess all the different laws in the whole process of chain? But I suspect these big global players will see an opportunity to penetrate more into the European market by doing the legwork for us. That's what I'm hoping, anyway.
Yeah, no, for sure. I'd like to think somebody would take a lot of the legwork, because a lot of the laws, I've not looked, but you can imagine a lot of the laws around the world could be quite difficult to interpret. There could be local matters that you need to consider in line with interpreting the law, ambiguities, case law. You can just imagine it could be a minefield trying to accurately assess what the
changes all the time as well, doesn't it? It's changing. We're on to Miles this morning in Dubai, and he was saying, you know, there's a new law coming out in Dubai, wasn't there?
There were, yeah, there were. I think I'm going to pop over just to assess those for us in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I'll get you on a Zoom for it, mate. Now, Paul's asking about transfers to Ireland, the Republic of Ireland. So, again, currently the UK is saying that they'll recognise the European Economic Area countries as being adequate, you know, having adequacy, so therefore having sufficient safeguards in place. So you don't need standard contractual clauses if your supplier is in Ireland. But again, if there's a chain of processors beyond Ireland, then you would need to cover those off, wouldn't you?
For sure. Well, one interesting point as well as a bit of a short discussion point would be, regardless of a European decision on adequacy, where would you stand if Ireland themselves said actually the UK is adequate and they're going to facilitate a transfer?
Well, I can't imagine that happening. I know that with the consistency mechanism and adequacy measures are signed off by the European Commission, aren't they? There's actually a decision that's ratified in law, isn't there?
From a member state point, yes, but and what about an independent state actually saying, well, actually, we don't see there's a problem with your laws independently outside of any EU mechanism?
Interesting thought.
Before obviously we get to the end of the session, because I know we've probably got quite a bit still to do, have we, Phil?
We're going to run out of time again.
What I'm going to say is, just so that everybody knows that's on here, that we can reconvene this, because obviously it is a big subject on everybody's list. If we can try and answer the questions that we've got today, that'd be great. And then we can set a date to reconvene and continue where we left off.
Yeah, sure. Now, one of Dave's, Claire's raised a good point. So one of Dave's customers is a data processor. They provide applicant tracking software across the world. And they're a processor based in the UK. Their issue is going to be, and we did that piece of work with Dubai Ports, and their HR function across the world is, or across Europe and Russia, and Europe and Russia is based in London. Mm-hmm. At that time, you know, two years ago, when I was doing the work with them, the French and the German and the Spanish ports were saying, we're not happy about transferring data to the UK. You know, that was because they didn't want the HR department overseeing what was going on. But, you know, basically, there's going to be a much bigger problem, because the French and the German and the Spanish terminals over there will now have to have in place standard contractual clauses or some other mechanism to lawfully transfer data to their HR department in the UK. And that's the same with your clients, isn't it, Dave? So, you know, their business is under pressure because of all this, isn't it?
For sure, because they've got some clients based in Italy. So you could use that as a example, really, of the difficulties that that's going to pose to them as a processor. Between the two.
Yeah, and it is getting the data. It's not so much getting data back. It's if you're providing a service to people in Europe, you know, they're going to have to jump through hoops if the UK isn't granted adequacy. And, you know, they have to use these mechanisms and go through these procedural steps that we've talked about. I don't know if we've...
Phil. I was just going to say, just on that, on the point of adequacy, do you not think realistically there's an argument to be made that, having seen particularly issues with what was essentially the American adequacy system, first Safe Harbour and then Privacy Shield, do you not think there's an argument to say that a UK adequacy decision might almost be irrelevant, and that we might end up relying almost exclusively on SCCs and these additional measures as standard because there's a lack of confidence in the UK adequacy decision? I don't know. It's just a point I've seen in commentary, and I thought it was probably worth bringing it up, whether actually at this point and especially considering our surveillance laws, the Snoopers Charter, where there might be a reluctance to rely on adequacy decision at all if it was granted.
Well, I don't know. I think, and I don't know if you, I read through the Japanese adequacy decision this morning just to try and get a feel for what kind of things, you know, they cover and in what depth. It takes, as Jason said last time, you know, a minimum of 18 months. There's an awful lot of work, I think, goes in, and it is a decision ratified by the European Commission. So I don't think that it's entered into in a light-hearted way, if you like. You know, I think there's an awful lot of work goes into determining whether a country's adequate, and they reserve the right to rescind the adequacy decision. So I think if an adequacy decision is arrived at and granted to the UK, it will be reliable. But the problem is, we might not get one.
And I've seen certainly commentary saying both ways, really, and there's some commentary suggesting that actually it may well just be a political thing, because we are relying to the GDPR and we are signatory member states to Convention 108 or 108 plus, which indeed this might be a good point just to bring it in, that it's again kind of an international agreement on cross-border processing and protection of personal data.
Yeah, the recital 105 and whatever article it is in the GDPR says that they're basically factors that can be taken into account to inform the adequacy decision. But just because you're a signatory to Convention 108 plus, I don't think that's going to automatically qualify, because there's how many
not automatically qualify for adequacy, but to be taken into account for adequacy.
Yeah,
along with the fact that other measures, such as the fact that we've got the GDPR and it will become the UK GDPR and that kind of thing. But in essence, taking all that outside of it, there's still an argument of, well, would Convention 108 still facilitate trade or facilitate transfers or cross-border transfers between members who have signed up to the agreement, to Convention 108 agreement?
Because I don't think it can, because it's not one of those safeguards that's listed in the GDPR. It's mentioned in the GDPR as something to factor take into account when considering adequacy, but it's not, you know, oh, by the way, you know, you've got standard contractual clauses, binding corporate rules, and membership of the or signatory to the Convention 108 plus. So I don't think it would go that far, personally.
So that would then lead you to think, well, what is the purpose of Convention 108 plus when it does talk about cross-border transfers between themselves and adequate measures in place and appropriate internal laws to give effect to Convention 108 and things? So it makes you then wonder, well, if the GDPR, if you don't need to rely on the GDPR and you've got this thing called the 108, but there may well be slightly lower standards, but surely Convention 108, if it's a mechanism to facilitate cross-border transfers, could potentially be called upon. But there's probably many more ins and outs that we need to think about that's maybe not going to be covered in the next few minutes before we wrap up. But it's certainly an interesting concept as to whether 108 would be sufficient in that sense. There are issues with it, I believe, but it's just whether as an international binding piece of law on data protection, whether it would be deemed appropriate to use.
Interesting. Amy's asking about guidance that the SCCs are currently not approved where a EU country is a data processor early. Well, that's all changed, Amy. So what they've got now, and if you've not read these, you've got new standard contractual clauses, and they're actually really structured in a difficult way. They contain four scenarios, which they call modules: controller to controller, controller to processor, processor to processor, and processor to controller. So that old gap that used to exist of processor to controller is now being closed off. You're happy to kind of have a session on these. They're really quite complicated, and there's a bunch of clauses, and each of those clauses is elaborated upon with different terms for each of these different modules. The way that it's put together is really quite hard to get your head around. But I think actually they're going to be quite effective. Have you looked at them yet, Dave?
Yeah, it was quite interesting. With them splitting out the four modules as opposed to a straight kind of controller processor, I'm quite interested in the processor to processor, or processors using it to sub-processors in that sense. Because I think it's an area where the current standard contractual clauses lack, quite frankly.
Yeah, it is. But rather than having different sets of contractual clauses, there's going to be one set now. And these are the requirements that's listed in section two, the kind of the meat of it. So, you know, defining purpose imitation as a requirement for processor to controller, because obviously the controller sets the purposes. So not all clauses apply to each of the different modules, if you like. And this is an overview of it all, but we probably need to get into more detail. So instructions, for instance, are required on all kind of processor agreements, but not controller to controller agreements, because controller determines their own purposes and means of processing, don't they? So again, interesting to look at, and we probably need to have a session on how to work with these, because they're about 38 pages long now, aren't they?
yeah. They'd certainly take your time to read through them, that's for sure.
Oh, and there's a huge, like, 2 pages of controls you've got to address. I mean, it's an awful lot of work now in repapering all your standard contractual clauses, I think.
Well, let's do it as a separate section then, because obviously we're going to have to revisit this again, because I think there's a lot of information that we still need to cover. So yeah, and I've got a few people reaching out to me, you know, for further information. So we might have to do some sector specific information on what we've discovered.
Yeah. Rosie makes a great point. I mean, tell me when we've got to shut up, Kathy, and we'll shut up. But Rosie's point about, you know, well, will the EU European Data Protection Board's recommendations and guidance, and in fact the European Court of Justice, will it matter after January? But if we're trying to seek adequacy, surely you'll have to take account of what they say.
I would have thought so for any kind of consistency. Otherwise, if you don't take account of what they said, eventually you'll diverge, won't there? There'll be this kind of parting of ways eventually as case law and bits develop themselves. So there's going to have to be some kind of tie mechanism, even if it's only the fact that the courts look to it for persuasive guidance as opposed to being precedent in that sense.
Yeah, Robert Montgomery raised the question, risk assessment hasn't been mentioned. I mean, it hasn't been mentioned explicitly, Robert, but this whole process is risk assessment. You know, the fact you're going to have to look at laws in countries and work practice in countries, and make a judgment as to whether you think, you know, that they are going to impede the rights and freedoms of individuals, that in itself is a risk assessment process. And then working out how these supplementary measures are going to be applied and whether they're effective and keep the whole thing under review. The whole thing to me is an enormous risk assessment, but multiplied over the number of transfers and processes you've got and multiplied again by the length of the chains you've got. So, you know, we haven't mentioned it explicitly, but the whole thing would appear to me to be a very large risk assessment process.
It would also highlight to me that it's from an organisational point about resource, about how you're actually going to address it all.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be a lot more work, so there's going to be a lot more resources needed to progress through what you've just discussed there.
Yeah, it's really quite onerous, isn't it, at the end of the day, especially for a small organisation.
For sure, yeah, for sure.
Well, it is, and that's why I think that, you know, the bigger companies, your international operators, are going to have to take the lead in saying, well, you know, look, these are the laws we've got in this country, and these are the work practices in this country. Once it's done once, it doesn't have to get done multiple times, does it? So somebody does a thorough job of assessing, you know, the applicability of the laws and how remedies can be relied upon by data subjects, then that piece of work should be applicable to everybody. Because it's
possibly applicable, but there'll still be the onus of making sure that it's maintained and up to date, accurate, because how quickly laws change and develop. So there's even if it's the big operators and big players that are doing, there's going to be a degree of monitoring it to make sure that if things change, that the cogs all work and it filters down accordingly, and actions change where actions needed to change. Mm-hmm.
And the supplementary measures, again, they'll probably standardise out. I mean, it all seems big and scary at the moment, but I'm sure, you know, it'll work its way through, and all this information will become much more clear about how different countries approach this and how different suppliers approach it. But I should imagine there's going to be a big shakeout. Those that can't afford to put in place these, you know, encryption measures and pseudonymization measures and compartmentalized processing measures and strong transport layer encryption, then, you know, I should imagine that they'll probably lose out, won't they, long term?
I think they will, and I think it comes back to Ollie's point about smaller operators and things. Just actually, and again, the point made about resources is, although the big players might put this in place, but how many smaller operators might actually understand what they're doing and understand the terms that are being used? And when you saw it saying we've got encryption TLS or transport layers in encryption, but how do you understand if it's adequate enough? Just because somebody's saying it's good, is it good enough? Or you got the latest version, for example, do you go with 1.1 or 1.2 of TLS, for example, and what's the differences between them? And it's that kind of bit I'm thinking about from a resources point, and that kind of bit with some of the clients going, will they have sufficient resources and knowledge to understand, even if the big players are putting these in place, to actually interpret them and understand them?
Yeah, I noticed somebody's asking for sort of DPOs in education to put their hands up. There's potentially a group wanting to get together to talk about SAR. Yeah. So I'm gonna
arrange a separate session for that, Phil, and reach out to everybody who's requested. So they want to talk about SAR, DPOs, etc., specific to their sector. So we can certainly do that. And we've got a few others asking for health specific. So, you know. We can, obviously this has been quite a broad session, but we're able to do specific sectors, you know, if required. So we'll pick on those afterwards and get something organised.
Yeah, okay. I think we've probably run out of time, haven't we, Cathy? I mean, a lot of people maybe are happy to sit on. We're happy to sit on and jack about this all afternoon, but we wanted to try and, I mean, it's a hellishly complicated subject, and it's changing every couple of weeks, and there's different interpretations and spins and issues being raised every couple of days. So we wanted to try and unpack it and talk it through. I don't know whether what we've done has confused matters more or helped to marshal thoughts. No, it's a lot clearer in my mind, having done a lot of the reading.
It has. I think it's obviously brought out a lot more questions as you're going through the topic. So there's definitely, we need to pick this back up probably next week. And then we can, you know, unpack it a little bit more.
I think the key is, okay, so what have I got to do? That's the key, isn't it? Everyone want to know, what do I have to do? I'm using MailChimp. I'm using Cognito Forms. What do I have to do? And when do I have to do it? So that's the bit we need to try and, you know, get under the skin of. We have to do this bit first, you know, which is, this is what the law now says, and this is the way it's being interpreted. Next stage is, so what? What do we do?
Yeah. Absolutely. So I'd like to thank everybody for, you know, attending. It's been great, and a lot of stuff to talk about on here. We certainly, Miles will pick it up and, you know, send people copies of the recording and, you know, any documentation that's been requested. And we'll take on board requests for other sectors on specific information. So, you know, you'll hear from us quite soon. Meanwhile, if you're really stuck on anything and, you know, you need a bit more, the support desk is available if you want to send a question in there. Thanks, Phil. Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Ollie.
Yeah, and thank you for waiting for me then due to the delivery of a different course. But it's been great to take part, and thanks for everybody.
Yes, yeah. Thank you to everyone for taking time to join us.
Great session.
See you soon. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thanks, everybody. All. See you soon.
Thank you.
Take care now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care.
You stop recording, Phil, yeah?
No, I will do that. Yeah. If I can figure out how to do that. So, yes, I am technically adept, so I have...